From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Type any word into Google, and the search engine will offer a drop-down list of suggestions for what you might be looking for. So, say you type Russia collusion. Delusion is how Google suggests you complete your search. If you click on that, and the first result is an opinion piece from the New York Post. The second, a Tucker Carlson interview on Fox News. Plus a handful of YouTube videos from channels with names like The Red Pill Christian Warrior. Those search results speak to something bigger. When you use Google, you're not just looking for information. Certain information is looking for you. Here to expand on how much influence big tech has on what information we consume is Francesca Tripodi. She's a sociologist and media scholar who joins us on the line from Denver. Hello, Francesca.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, so you recently published a report called Searching for Alternative Facts, Analyzing Scriptural Inference in Conservative News Practices. What led you there?
Well, this was actually a pretty in-depth research project that started with this idea of just better understanding how Trump supporters look for news and what kind of news they value and trust. I feel like there was an underlying narrative coming up about media literacy, which kind of assumed Trump supporters were these cultural dupes that were tricked into fake news, if you will. And I felt like there was more to that story.
So to find out more, you went to work with, or embed yourself, actually, with conservative communities in Virginia. Tell us about some of the people that you met there.
Definitely. So I was embedded inside of two Republican groups, a women's group and a college group. They both knew that I was a researcher, so I wasn't undercover, if you will. But I met a lot of really amazing people that I would have not otherwise interacted or engaged with. And I met a lot of very highly educated and well-off individuals as well. I was trying to engage with the Trump supporter that is outside of the narrative that people kind of have, I think, of Trump supporters.
You mean the sort of angry, out-of-work man?
Exactly, right. Yeah. I wanted to engage with upper-middle-class conservatives, essentially, those who were either already had their college degree or were working on a college degree and were actively involved in the Republican Party.
And these are all people who self-identified as conservative. You wanted to learn how they got their news. Now, of course, part of the story of election 2016 was so much fake news circulating on Facebook and, according to many sources, Russian bots on Twitter. But so why did you zero in on Google?
Well, actually, Google was a pattern that rose during my data analysis. So Google actually came to me, if you will. Mm-hmm. I started with very basic interviews. I centered my research project surrounding the governor's race that was happening in the state of Virginia last year. And the project started with very informal conversations with people exiting the polls during the primary. And I would start with a very simple question. How do you go for news? Where do you go for news that you trust? And this was often met with just kind of laughter or shaking of heads. And so they were saying, you know, I don't really have a news source that I trust. And so I would follow up saying, well, how did you learn about the candidate you just voted for? And this was always met with, well, I Googled it.
Huh.
And that very much surprised me.
because they were doing they're doing their due diligence. They're looking for a neutral source.
Exactly. An unbiased neutral source. And so luckily, this was how my project started. And then I was able to, in more in-depth interviews and through my direct participant observation within these groups, see more about how the role of Google plays in, quote-unquote, doing your own research.
Well, let's look at that. The example we just mentioned, you know, Russia collusion. What comes up is Russia collusion delusion. In other words, invalidating the idea that there was collusion. So what are some of the other examples of how autocomplete narrows choices to, let's say, with ideological underpinnings?
So I think that Google definitely has a role to play in this, and specifically with the autocomplete. But one of the underlying arguments in my report is thinking about how the user's own ideological positions are embedded in what we search.
Okay.
Right? So not only does Google help lead us down certain paths, if you will. What we put into Google to begin with very much matters. And even though many of us are very critical of the media, quote unquote, I think few of us are critical of these search engines and the way in which what we put into it dramatically changes what we get out of it. And so one of the examples that I put in my report is, you know, NFL ratings way down, right? So this during the governor's race, there was all of the discussion happening over the NFL protests, and President Trump tweeted that the NFL ratings were way down as a result of these protests. And so if you Googled NFL ratings way down, you got all this news that was saying they were down. But if you Googled NFL ratings up, which is not looking directly at his text, but rather challenging what he has to say, you get very different information, basically saying, well, yeah, NFL ratings might be down, but it's more complicated than that, and it's not directly correlated to these protests that are taking place right now.
So, President Trump would think. Given Google's algorithm, so if somebody who had a liberal or progressive bent and, you know, searched on a lot of things about progressive politics, or if they put in NFL ratings, would they get different choices?
So, that is a great question. You know, my project was not specifically focused on Google autocomplete, so I'm not quite sure. Because right now, if I look at the Google autocomplete, NFL ratings is just telling me 2018, 2017, by year, et cetera. I think that the autocomplete, I think we want to put a lot more of the onus on Google than think a little bit more about how our own search patterns are influencing what Google gives back to us. I think that the algorithms that Google puts in are built by people, right? And so I think we often try to think of this algorithm as something that is neutral or unbiased without thinking about, well, the information that we're putting into it is also reflective of our own opinion.
Who and what we are. Francesca Tripodi is with me. She did extensive research on looking for alternative news and worked in reporting with conservative groups in Virginia. Bart Wojcinski is also with us. He's an assistant professor of journalism at the University of Georgia. He's found Google is not the only place where people search to find information, of course. Bart, hello and welcome.
Hey, good morning, Virginia.
So you study the relationship between media and psychology. So let's dig into that. When it comes to links people see on media, what influences them to click?
Well, one of the things that we found is as people are skimming through Twitter feeds, Facebook feeds, these ways that actually have become, for more than half Americans, the way they access news. That's where they go to find these things. They look for things that catch their attention. And often, one of the things that factors whether or not they're actually going to click through and go to the actual body of a story is the image that's contained in those social media posts. Images that make people feel a certain way, they can be sort of more, they can trigger positive emotions or negative emotions, are ones that are more likely to get people to stop as they're scrolling through this feed and more likely to get them to click through and read what's going on.
So you actually followed people's eye patterns and see where they land.
Yeah, we've done a couple of studies where we've either looked at sort of people looking at a series of posts, or we have done some where we've kind of constructed a social media newsfeed. And, obviously there are certain words that also get people to stop on headlines, but images play a big role in whether people sort of stop and bother to read that story at all. And then that, like I said, that governs their exposure to the actual story once they get through.
So you're looking at how a website presents information to get people to stop. Francesca, I'm interested in the motivation or the ideology that one brings to it. In fact, you found that Google's algorithm leads mainline conservatives to more far-right or alt-right content. Part of your finding is conservatives tend to interpret the information they read differently. This is something you call scriptural inference. Now, what does that mean?
Oh, thank you for asking me that. So scriptural inference is a form of media literacy that I learned during Bible study. In very basic terms, it's a compare and contrast focused on the word that prioritizes direct analysis of primary sources. And so one of the central arguments in my report is that conservatives who embody a Christian worldview transfer this practice of scriptural inference to other sources outside of the Bible. So essentially, they're giving authoritative weight to original texts. That could be a transcript of the president's speech or the Constitution. And then they're critically interrogating mainstream media using these same tools as well.
Yeah, so that really does buck up against this idea that, you know, conservatives just take everything in that conservative media says and don't question it.
Definitely. And so I think this idea of doing your own research is very much rooted in a Protestant breaking down of the Bible, really drilling into these concepts. And while not all Christians are conservatives, nor all conservatives religious, I think this practice of returning to an authoritative text and leveraging this personal dissection is fundamentally bound to evangelical churches and is really trickling down into conservative methods of inquiry.
So in a way, we have this idea that people search out things that reinforce their own belief systems. What would you say, having looked at these groups, how they consume media vis-a-vis, you know, just reinforcing what you think?
So one thing that really surprised me in my study was the number of different sources that people are reading and the ways in which people are consuming news. So some of the older participants in my study definitely watch Fox News, but they're also reading a wide variety of sources, Wall Street Journal, the New York Times even. The college students were enrolled in multiple news alerts on their iPhone, not just from more of the conservative leading content, but they had CNN alerts coming in. But what I think is really fascinating is that they are critically interrogating the messages that they receive from mainstream media and favoring this concept of the original word, right? So in the same way that Protestants value their own interpretation of the Bible over a priest, there is also this concept of shunning journalistic interpretation of events in favor of studying the original speeches or the original documents.
Google in itself is, you know, is the question, is Google ideological? Right. I mean, it is based on, the algorithm is based on the idea that a lot of people search on something, so you're going to be looking for the most popular search.
Definitely.
What's the response there? And from Google, did you talk with them about this?
So I have actually had conversations with the director of Google News, and I think this is something that Google is deeply invested and interested in, right? They understand that they're part of how people gain information. But I think it's very interesting to also think about how our own searches are laced with ideological underpinnings. I mean, something just as simple as separation of church and state, right? So if you Google separation of church and state versus Googling wall of separation, you will have a very different ideological return in your results. And that is something that I think we aren't taking enough consideration in, is the ways in which our own searches might be keeping us in these filter bubbles, even though we think we're trying to access information that is different from what we believe or counter to what we already believe.
Francesca Tripodi, sociologist and media scholar, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I had a great time.
Well, good. Bart, we're going to keep you around because we want to explore this idea of how people consume media, what they track on, and how they can actually detect fake news. That's coming up. Also, just ahead, Atlanta's Brazilian community rallies for the sixth World Cup win, they hope. But first, what is fake news and how can we avoid it? This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Nearly a quarter of Americans admit that they have shared fake political news stories online, and that's according to the Pew Research Center. So why do so many of us fall for fake news and then pass it along, even if we may suspect it is untrue? And how do we figure out what is real? Part of the solution is checking the facts. Daniel Funke reports on global fact-checking efforts for the Poynter Institute, and he's joining us on the line from St. Petersburg, Florida. Good morning, Daniel.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
And we've also been speaking with Bart Wojdynski. He's an assistant journalism professor at the University of Georgia. And Bart, I do want to start with you after having talked with Francesca. listening to how people actually may not necessarily be seeking out fake news, but you've researched how people determine whether or not what they're reading is credible. So how can they make that judgment?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think news consumers on their own have ideas of what they look for when they're looking at an article and trying to figure out if it's credible. So we've done some research where we sort of ask people what they think they look at, and everybody says, oh, I definitely look at the source. I look at the URL in my browser to make sure it's credible. I look at the byline and timestamp. But then when we've taken different groups of people and brought them in and showed them different articles, some of which were published by reputable sources, some of which were from more kind of fringe sources, had incorrect information, that kind of stuff, it turns out that people don't actually look at the things they say they do very often.
So they're reporting that they're a little more vigilant about it than they may be in real life.
Yeah, it may be a little bit of Lake Wobegon syndrome. Everybody thinks they're a little above average in scrutinizing information, but we've done some studies where we found that fewer than 20% of people ever look for or look at the byline, look at a timestamp. Fewer than 30%, I think, looked at headlines on the story. So this was in a case where they clicked on an article from a social media post. So by the time they've loaded the article from the social media page, they're ready to dive in and start reading. And they actually don't look at that peripheral information that may be giving them clues as to whether it's a reputable source or it's timely or any of these other things.
Now, Daniel, fact-checking has always been a critical part of news operations, but you report on fact-checking and global misinformation. Is misinformation the same thing as fake news?
Yeah, so misinformation is a broader category that encompasses fake news. Fake news, in the traditional sense, is any kind of story, meme, video that is fabricated with the goal of tricking people to make some kind of profit, primarily through advertising revenue. And misinformation is, you can think of it as almost like a bucket that fake news sits in. And within that are also fake videos, fake social media posts, any kind of like hoax you can think of sits in the bucket of fake news
and
or
you've,
misinformation.
You've interviewed a few self-identified online trolls who actually write fake news stories. So what have they told you about their motivations for doing this? You mentioned advertising, which is dollars, but how about ideology?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think something that a lot of people don't understand about fake news writers is that they don't necessarily see themselves in the way that the public does. So there's one really infamous hoaxer in Maine who is the subject of a lot of Snopes fact checks, who considers himself a satirist. And in conversations on Facebook, we've talked about how his goal is actually to publish fake stuff with the goal of getting conservative-leaning users to share it, thereby making them look dumb and thereby trolling them. So he, in his mind, he's a liberal, and he's trying to show everyone how dumb conservatives are by tricking them into sharing his satirical stories. But he doesn't really see himself as a misinformation purveyor, and that's pretty typical for the one-man fake news operations I've seen.
Well, Snopes is one of the organizations, along with the AP, PolitiFact, other fact-checking organizations that are now working with Facebook to try and check some of these stories. This is something that Facebook announced, that they're partnering with these organizations to help prevent the spread of fake news. How does that work?
Yeah, so we're about a little more than a year and a half into this program, and it came about after the 2016 election when fact-checkers were fed up with Facebook's lack of attention that they are paying to fake news on the platform. So basically, they partnered with the project that I work for, the International Fact-Checking Network at the Poynter Institute, and members of our code of principles are allowed to participate in this program. Our code stipulates things like you must list your sources, you must list your authors, all that kind of good stuff to make sure that fact-checking organizations are up to snuff. And the program lets these fact-checking organizations see what users have reported on the platform, what's going viral, and they will check those stories to see if they're true or not. And if they debunk them, then Facebook automatically lowers those stories in the newsfeed, and their reach will decrease by up to 80%. So essentially, people won't see stories that fact-checkers have debunked as false.
Well, is it working? I mean, it's not as if every overstatement by a politician or a pundit may not be technically true is going to be lowered in the newsfeed, is it? I mean, would that be editorial?
Yeah, so I think there's two things there, right? So the first is that we would love to know how this program is going. Facebook is very infamously guarded about its data and its proprietary algorithms. So they haven't been really forthcoming with, you know, how much this is actually decreasing the level of misinformation that people are seeing. But in you know, conversations with fact checkers like PolitiFact, they tell me that this has really helped them scale up their work by actually showing them what people are seeing in terms of misinformation, whereas before they relied on mostly reader emails to determine what to fact check. So they see it as a success, but we would love to see some concrete data, because I think if you think about it, it's way easier to create a fake news story and get a lot of reach on Facebook than it is to do a time-consuming fact check. So that's a real challenge that fact checkers are faced with, is how do we combat this huge problem where, you know, fake news websites often copy each other too, to broaden their reach, whereas fact checkers have to work like on a one fact check for almost an entire day to make sure that they have the right sources, the right wording, all that kind of stuff. So there's both those problems there.
And Bart, you've done some research on this, how people actually do change their behavior when they're taught how to identify fake news. What did you find?
Yeah, we've done some recent studies with a couple of grad students of mine, Brittany Jefferson and Matt Binford, where we've taken some of the people that come into the study and we've given them a little bit of a warning or just a reminder that misinformation is out there. In our case, we weren't even looking at the political stuff, but more the science information. There's a lot of sort of anti-globalist, whether it's anti-GMO or anti-climate change, kind of conspiracy science fake news, which is sort of that's where this stuff was really going on prior to the 2016 election. And so we've just reminded some people, hey, just so you know, here's the volume of fake science news that was shared last year. Other people didn't get the warning. And people who did get the warning were much more likely to correctly identify out of the articles they looked at next, which ones were fake. Now, they were more vigilant about all the articles. I think they were more skeptical. So we showed them a couple of legitimate articles, and they were a little more skeptical there. But the only ones where there was a significant difference was the fake ones. So they were actually more likely to look at the clues on the design page or the URL or the source of the information and actually, you know, take a second to think, wait, is this a source I've heard of? Do I know anything about this? Actually, this might be fake. Whereas if they're not thinking about fake news, that doesn't necessarily happen.
So, Daniel, Facebook is changing its strategy to downplay this fact check label. I'm wondering how people react to seeing a disclaimer or seeing that something was disproven in the articles that they're reading and think they're not legit.
Yeah, so that's actually an interesting case of how Facebook is responding to relevant academic research on this problem. So basically, they changed that feature, I believe it was in December, and it used to say disputed when a fact checker debunked a story and someone by chance saw the story on the platform. But some research found that users didn't respond very well to that label. When someone saw that something was debunked and the story aligned with their political ideology, they were continuing to double down and read that story. But so this study, I think it was at a Northeastern university, found that if you just list the fact check and some relevant objective news stories in the related article section right below the story on Facebook, it's more likely to discourage someone from clicking on that story and sharing that story, and more likely to encourage them to actually read the fact check and the facts about that story.
So, Bart, given your research, just put a fancy image there of a puppy and people will go for that anyway?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, yeah, that's puppies and cats are probably going to draw people's attention. But I think, I mean, I think with that change, the stuff that Daniel's talking about, one of the things they found was that, like I said, the disputed label can be kind of an ideological trigger that helps people kind of consume information in a motivated way, right? I think if you hold a belief that you feel like a lot of other people don't, or that's challenged, and you see something that validates it, that's the stuff that people, you know, at either end of the political spectrum get really pulled into. Where it's like, oh, wait, I hold this view that's not very common, but look, here's something that validates it. Oh, and look, other people are disputing it. That gives them a kind of real motivation to dive in, read the article, and then, you know, later on, they might not even remember whether they read it from a credible source or not, but they'll remember the information.
Well, Bart, we have to leave it there. Bart Wojdynski, he is assistant professor of journalism at UGA. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Daniel Funke, he is a fact-checking reporter at the Poynter Institute. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Atlanta-based glam punks Material Girls' first full-length album, Leather, comes out today. Maybe you heard the band on NPR's All Songs Considered. We called Home Court Advantage and asked the group's frontman, Ben Presley, he of the heavy eyeliner, for some additions to our Georgia playlist.
You ready?
New 0-point range.
Hey, this is Ben from Material Girls, and my first pick for the playlist is The Pleasure Points, The Salt of the Universe. I picked the song because it's... Actually, let me just think for one second. I'm really bad at the falsetto, but that's my favorite part when Jacob's like... I don't know what he's saying, but it's great. Super funky. I picked this song because I really believe in the people involved in the project, The Pleasure Point. It's a collaborative project, but it's definitely Jacob's brainchild, and he was living at the same house as me for a while in the middle room, and so you could hear him working on it pretty regularly, but yeah, he's very proficient. It's great sampling. I know he's not like trained really on any instruments, but he's kind of doing a record by himself. I think that's really cool. Sonically, it's an amazing song. It's got a really good beat, funky bass line, kind of makes you want to dance. It's got great kind of dual vocal characteristics. It's kind of disorienting. It almost makes me feel like I'm floating, you know, in a lazy river. The second song I picked for the playlist is Tongueless World by Background, another great local Atlanta band. It's very creepy with the dual vocal, the high and the low, over that kind of funky bass line, and then it just warps into madness. It's a great example of some good Atlanta no wave. I think the first time I heard that song was when we played with them at Southern Comfort. Super fun time. I've mostly only been to karaoke there, so playing a show there was great. We played on the floor. We had to bring our own PA, and so it was weird being in that big room, but everybody danced and kind of partied with us. We had a great time. Let me think for just a moment. Except some darkened tunnels where someone had burned the masks to the places where they scattered all your ashes. One of the things I really like about Background is, for one thing, they're all, you know, you can tell, pushing the limits of their instruments, really interesting drum beats, patterns. Funky guitars, like, I don't know, it's very cool to see some people pushing the limits of you know, what people expect sonically from a band, or band stereotypes, like two guitars, bass, drums, whatever, chords, guitar solo, bridge, ending, like, they're not worried about any of that. That song in particular has this great, just chaos. Every once in a while they just, it's like a controlled cool element, and then it all kind of explodes, and using like a saxophone or a slide guitar to break the mold and make some horrifying noise is beautiful. I like that.
That was Ben Presley of Material Girls with his picks for our Georgia playlist. Their debut full-length album, Leather, is out today. For more sounds, visit gpbnews.org. Atlanta's Brazilian community will rally hard for today's big game against Belgium. We're going to get a taste of their exuberant fandom just ahead. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jack Barsky led a double life in the U.S. for 10 years. Now the former KGB spy lives quietly with his family in Covington, Georgia. On Monday, we're going to meet him and get his take on the upcoming summit between President Vladimir Putin and Trump. Is there an interesting Georgian that you would like to meet on the radio? Leave us your interview suggestions. You can leave a voicemail at 404-500-9457, or you can find us on Twitter or on Facebook. And then be sure to join us on Monday at 9 a.m. for some spycraft and more. Well, it may not feel like Friday on this broken up week, but it is, and this is the day for On Second Thought's weekly roundtable. Today, we've gathered three people who work with technology from different generations to talk about their own internet habits and how they have or have not changed their behavior. Gautam Beliappa is Vice President of Cognitive Artificial Intelligence and Big Data Practice for North America at Capgemini, and he's on the phone with us. Hello, Gautam.
Hello and good morning.
Good morning to you. And in the studio with me, Jamie Gottlieb. She's a content manager for an Atlanta startup. It's called Rhodey. Hello, Jamie.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
And Heather Wun is here. She's a UGA computer science grad, former intern at Google, currently getting her master's degree at the University of Illinois. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we just heard a lot about how deeply technology influences and plays with our sort of emotions and ideology and the way that we seek and consume information. Love to get a little bit on your own habits for where you get your news. Gautam, let's start with you.
Sure. I subscribe to the print. Yes, paper edition of the Wall Street Journal.
No. Are you the only person that you know that gets newsprint on your fingers?
No, I get most of the people who work for me to subscribe to, you know, the paper edition of something. The tactile feeling during breakfast, I think, you know, helps with retention. It's just part of my morning routine that I've never gotten rid of. I, you know, also listen to a lot of NPR podcasts. I'm on the road quite a bit. My favorites are The Hidden Brain, Planet Money, and The Indicator.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, I also read, you know, one or two business papers a week from our competitors in the top business schools. And I read for about 30 minutes before I go to bed. At night, mostly fiction, space and engineering related fiction.
All right. How about you, Jamie?
I'm a little bit different. I get most of my news from newsletters, actually. It's a really great way to have in your email digestible, quick content that gives you both a high level and a slightly deep dive into the topics of the day. If I want to learn more about a certain topic, I'll go to kind of my staples, either the New York Times or Recode for technology and business news. And, you know, on top of that, of course, you know, I, you know, like to get some, you know, fun lifestyle news. Like, it's not unusual for me to go to Refinery29 to get some horoscope or fashion lifestyle, things like that. But really, in terms of like deep diving into stories and getting information, it is more the traditional news media and outlets.
How about you, Heather?
So I do use Facebook. So a lot of my friends like to post news, and a lot of them are people who keep up with news. I also do use email a lot of times. So I'll get email alerts from Twitter, or I'll get email alerts from medium.com and things like that on popular posts. That's usually a lot of big news. And then sometimes I'll use Reddit. So a lot of times when I'm looking for something in particular, for a particular topic, sometimes Reddit is usually the best place for me to go.
Now, you're a former intern at Google, correct?
Yes.
So how reliant on you are you on Google for actually finding out, you know, say you see something on Twitter, will you go to Google and look for more on a news story?
So a lot of times I will go to Google to look up stuff on a news story, mostly because I tend to see stuff and then I want to like see other sources and see what are other people saying before I can make a decision on whether I trust that particular information or not.
So do you use that autocomplete function? Like say you're looking at, you know, we heard the example, NFL ratings up or down.
So sometimes I won't really use the autocomplete. I'll just kind of type in the topic and see kind of what's out there. But definitely, you know, if I saw something that's like, you know, NFL ratings are down, then I might end up searching NFL ratings are down since that's what the prompt words were.
So this is machine learning, that this is an algorithm that takes into account how you look at things and how you view the world and gives you results based on that. People are pretty anxious about big picture AI, you know, artificial intelligence is going to take over the world or take our jobs or eliminate my job or whatever, or surpass human intelligence. But so many of us actually use things like Alexa, they use Google, we use all sorts of different forms of ways of predicting our behavior in our regular life. It sounds like it's a brave new world, but Gautam, you're in the business, so to speak. What do you think? Is it really a brave new world, or has AI quietly been in our lives for a long time?
I think AI, you know, is more pervasive than most people realize. It's commonplace, from simple applications like Amazon suggesting what you should purchase to ads on Google and YouTube customized for you, the movie recommender on Netflix, you know, the routing algorithms on Waze, the image recognition features on Facebook and Google. Like it or not, AI is a big part of our lives and it's growing, right? We have a saying at Capgemini, we say the fourth industrial revolution is one driven by data and AI.
Mm.
Its societal impact is becoming so pervasive that even their makers are getting concerned about, you know, its unfettered organic growth.
Right. Well, so you are capturing it. You are using it to your advantage. Heather, you taught at a camp on AI for young students. What did they think about this? Is this totally normal to them or does it seem like a threat?
So I know a lot of them come in being very scared about AI. So a lot of them are, they'll tell me, oh, well, you know, I'm really nervous about AI. I'm not sure, like, if I really want this in my life and things like that. But as they start to program, they'll learn that the AI is only as smart as you, the programmer, can make it. And so for them, they kind of get this perspective that the AI is kind of based off of what we know. And then they can kind of use that to their advantage.
And Jamie, this is something that you're doing at Rhodey. You manage digital marketing for Rhodey. This is a startup here in Atlanta. Quickly, how does the Rhodey model work?
Yeah, so Rhodey is an on-the-way delivery service. We connect people and businesses that have items to send with drivers already heading in the right direction.
So if I need something brought from Georgia to California, you find somebody who's driving?
Yeah, it could be Georgia to California if you need to send a couch you bought off Craigslist. But also locally, we actually work with a lot of retailers, home improvement stores, printers, things like that. We recently announced a partnership with Delta where we're delivering delayed baggage for them, reuniting bags with customers.
So you're connecting people to goods. So how much info does Rhodey ask for people to share when signing up for this app?
Standard sharing economy protocols and applications for our drivers. Of course, we background check our drivers, ask for a valid insurance and, ID as well, and to pay them, you know, via direct deposit their bank account information. Senders, when they post items, we ask them to post photos. We allow for real-time tracking as well, so you can see where your items are at every point in the process. And we actually partner with UPS Capital to offer insurance. So there are a lot of different ways that we're able to understand our users' preferences and what they like and how they like to interact with the app.
So understand users' preferences. Heather, you're a programmer. What do you think of when you hear that?
Usually
this
that
is
means,
all algorithms, right?
Yeah, usually that means you have a lot of data and you kind of use that to, like, in Google where you do predictive text.
So you're a person who works in technology. How much information are you willing to give to the websites and apps that you use?
So I tend to try to not give a lot of information. So I, for example, I turn off my location for a lot of things. For example, on Google Maps, I don't actually have the Google Maps app. I use my native like Apple apps, maps, because I didn't want to give Google like my location information and have them like know where I was.
What's the fear there? Why would you not want them to know that?
It's mostly just kind of the idea of like, I want to keep hold of my own privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I know like, for example, I know some people, one of the big things we learned when we were at Google was that they like to like be able to keep hold of the information. And sometimes people who, you know, are unsavory might want to get a hold of that information.
Right.
And sometimes they have to like try to keep those people away. But, you know, now you're trusting them to keep hold of all of that. And sometimes I just want to be able to search something and not have it follow me around. So Sometimes I'll like Google stuff and then see it as an ad. So sometimes I'll disable scripts on websites so I don't have to have those cookies and things like that following me around.
So you know that to be true. You know how they use this information. But I think most people, you know, they use Facebook, they use Google Maps, and they think, okay, well, maybe they've got some of my information, but it's worth the convenience. Gautam, what do you think? How often do you make that kind of bargain in your head?
I make the bargain in my head in two ways. One is, you know, I give information when I need something back. It's a sharing economy. So, you know, when we have apps for free, you need to give something in return. I also, you know, you don't always need to give accurate information. You don't need to put in your right age on Facebook. My wife doesn't have a real name or a real address or any kind of real information. You know, in my mind, the sharing economy has been, you know, been active for a long time. You take the credit reporting agencies, for instance, right? They control, you know, key data about us without our consent. Their fundamental business model is to treat us like products. The tech applications are the next generation of it. You know, the better, kinder versions of it. And, you know, so I share as much as I need. And like, you know, the other person said, I turn off location information. I delete, you know, apps when I don't use them. And then I re-engage them when I need them.
Hmm. Any of you are always online or do you ever try to detox? Jamie?
Well, I like to think that I like to detox, but practically my generation came out of the womb with a laptop in their hands. So when I'm home, I definitely create boundaries between, you know, work and in regular life balance, try and shut off my email. But I am very susceptible to, you know, browsing an Instagram feed and going on Netflix. I even have an Alexa as well, where I listen to music. So technology is really integrated into my day to day for that convenience that you mentioned, but also access to information and, you know, really exciting topics, things like that.
Heather, quickly, how about you? Do you ever detox from your media?
Lately, I've definitely been detoxing, especially since I went abroad recently. And during that time, I was able to be on airplane mode and not have constant messages, constant following. And that kind of helped prepare me to do that.
That was Heather Woon. She joins me, also Gautam Beliappa and also Jamie Gottlieb, telling us a little bit about how they use your media. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
The World Cup continues today as 8 countries advance to the quarterfinals. Brazil beat Mexico 2-0 to get there, and that win carried reverberations from Russia to Marietta, Georgia, which thousands of Brazilians call home. On Second Thought, producer Leighton Rowell joined them for the game and brought back this audio postcard.
My name is Ana. I'm from Recife, Brazil. Moro em Atlanta 35 anos. Go Brazil! We are at the real Brazilian restaurant on Powers Ferry, and it's a great environment here. All the Brazilian fans are proud to be here and be Brazilians. Football means everything in Brazil. It's the number one sport. Doesn't matter if it's the World Cup, but every day in Brazil is football day. When Brazil play on the World Cup, the whole Brazil shuts down. Nobody work. Everybody take off to watch Brazil game. I wish America was more passionate about soccer, about football like the rest of the world are. Back then in 1982, my first World Cup here was real hard. We didn't have internet, television and satellite. So, but I never miss the World Cup. This year going to be the year. Brazil going to win. 2-0 Brazil over Mexico. You need to take care more of the ball. They are giving a lot of free shots to Mexico, and I don't like that. It's scary. But Brazil is Brazil. Always come back. Go, 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 go! Come on, Neymar! Of course, Neymar is my favorite one. He's just the second Pelé. Nobody's like Pelé, but she's pretty close to Pelé.
Go! They did a great job getting numbers in the box. We were just talking about that. They had three people there ready to bury that thing. Awesome.
I'm Melissa Center. I was born and raised here in Georgia. My family is Brazilian. I actually met my husband on the soccer field at Kennesaw Mountain when we were both coaching high school. I was helping coach at Kennesaw Mountain, and he's the head coach at Hillgrove, and we kind of met on the sideline, and here we are 7 years later, and got a little girl, and life is good.
My name is Shannon Center, and I was born and raised in New York, but have lived in Georgia for 23 years. It's always a great atmosphere when you get together for a Brazil game because it's a community of people that truly rally behind their team and their country. It's so much fun to come in and see everybody standing up and everybody cheering and everybody singing the national anthem. It's a really cool environment. You know, there's so much of it that's X's and O's and technical and tactical, but there's also a lot of it that's just emotion and passion and momentum, and it's fun to watch. It's truly the beautiful game.
Attack, but today it all turned out great. And I'm so happy. Go Brazil!
Odds are good that there's going to be an even more passionate crowd at Rio Steakhouse in Marietta today at 2 p.m. when Brazil meets Belgium in the World Cup quarterfinals. That is our show for today. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is On Second Thought. Have a great weekend and may the best team win.